Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'll start with a model of executive power over war that the framers rejected, and that was the model of William Blackstone in his commentaries. He said that everything in external affairs, war powers, foreign policy, was for the executive, such as declaring war, appointing ambassadors, making treaties, issuing letters of marque for private citizens to engage in military activities, reprisals, small wars. All this was for the executive. And that was a position that the framers rejected. And if you look at the Philadelphia debates, only one person, Pierce Butler, supported a president taking the country from a state of peace to a state of war. All the other framers were appalled at that. They did not want to put that kind of power in the hands of one person. Now, some of you read the Federalist Papers. One that doesn't get much attention is number 4 by John Jay. And John Jay explained why the framers did not support presidential wars. And what the framers did was to look at wars in the past conducted, and what they found is that executives go to war not for the national interest. They go to war for the basis of fame, for fortune, for ambition, for family reasons, any reason at all. But the wars themselves were calamitous, and they led to huge losses of life and treasure. So that's why the framers wrote the Constitution the way they did. And you will not find any of Blackstone's prerogatives in the president in Article 2. They're either all in Article 1 under Congress, or they are shared by the president and the Senate on treaty making and appointments. If you look at the early decisions by the Supreme Court starting in 1800, everyone understood that the only branch capable of taking the country to war was Congress. That was fully understood in Congress, in the executive branch, and in the courts. So in 1800 and 1801, when you had the first two Supreme Court decisions on war having to do with the quasi-war against France from 1798 to 1800, the court looked solely at Congress for the source of authority. John Marshall said that expressly. There's only one branch you look for in terms of war power authority. That is Congress. And the issue there was whether Congress had to declare war or whether Congress could also authorize war as it did against France. And the Supreme Court said Congress constitutionally could do either one. No one looked to the president for any independent presidential power. In 1804, John Marshall decided a case, again in time of war, where Congress had passed a statute authorizing the president to pick up ships, but restricted it, and John Adams, as president, issued a proclamation going beyond the statute. It's a very interesting decision because initially, you don't see this in decisions anymore, but John Marshall said, you know, when I first got this case, I thought I'd have to hold for the commander of the ship because the commander is under the president, and it's just sort of line authority. The more I thought about it, however, national policy was made by Congress, and statute would therefore trump anything that a president did by proclamation. Always looking to Congress for authority. Some years ago, a senator said that, of course, a president can go to war on his own because that's what Thomas Jefferson did with the Barbary Wars. I stayed up a Friday night to do a 6-page report on that when I was at the Congressional Research Service. And I said, Jefferson did not go to war on his own. He came to Congress. He said, I took certain actions, but beyond the line of defense, I cannot go. I'm coming to you to get authority. So Congress passed 10 statutes authorizing Jefferson and Madison. And I sent a copy to this member of Congress's office who had made that comment on the floor. And they called me over. First, they said they want all the original documents I used. So I said, that's a good idea. Let them look at this. And then they said, we want you to come over and talk about it. And I did. And as we're talking, they said, the president didn't need statutory authority. I said, they had 10 statutes. I gave them to you. So about a year later, the same member is on the floor saying, of course, the president can go to war anytime he wants because of Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary War. So not a big learning curve. 1800 is a famous speech by John Marshall when he was a member of the House of Representatives, and he said that the president is sole organ. And the Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department used that, the president being sole organ, to imply and state that the president has independent, exclusive power in foreign affairs and war powers. I don't have time to go into this. Any of you who have an interest in a little more detail, if you want to email me, it's just lfisher@loc.gov. And I recently in Utah a couple days ago gave a paper that gives more details. But all that John Marshall meant in his speech in 1800 is that when there's a statute or a treaty telling the president how to turn over suspects to another country, extradition, that the president becomes the sole organ in implementing the statute or the treaty, not the sole organ in making any policy. So you can look at a little more detail on that. The prize cases in 1863, Justice Department will cite that as this is the blockade case in the Civil War, as independent authority for the president. If you look at Justice Greer, he says that we're dealing here with a domestic conflict, not going to war abroad. And if we were going to war abroad, that would be for Congress alone. And the attorney for the president, for Lincoln, said exactly the same thing in oral argument. If this is going outside the country, a war against another country, that would be for Congress, the sovereign power. In the talk I gave a few days ago in Utah, I talk about the court being involved in war power cases. Many people think today that the courts have no jurisdiction and no competence. Starting in 1800, Supreme Court and lower courts regularly took war power cases. They never said we didn't have jurisdiction, we don't have competence. That was certainly true up to the Steele seizure case of 1952 with Truman and the Korean War. And it is true that in the Vietnam years, federal courts ducked war power cases initially from 1966 to 1970, then started to see that they do have a role on this. So if you look at the whole history of the United States, courts have a legitimate constitutional role in deciding matters of war and the use of force. Doesn't mean that they micromanage, but they have a legitimate role. I want to end. I'm sorry I don't have any PowerPoints. I'm sure you missed that. So I want to end with this comment about what disturbs me the most right now on our constitutional system, and that is the claim that the president has inherent power. The Supreme Court will tell the country that this is a constitution of enumerated powers. That's not true. I don't know why the court would say that. We don't enumerate everything in the Constitution. We have express powers. You can read them. And then you have powers you can legitimately draw from express powers, implied powers. All three branches have implied powers. Inherent power. What could that mean? Because if you look at any dictionary you want to, inherent has to do with the nature of something or something that is intrinsic to something. And once you go into that direction with inherent power, you've just gone outside the Constitution. You've gone outside any possible system of checks and balances. And you've also opened opportunity to have no rule of law except what the president wants to do. And my own position for years has been that our rights and liberties are not protected by the Bill of Rights. Soviet Union and other countries always have a great Bill of Rights and that mean nothing at all. So the framers, with their view of human nature, and it hasn't changed in the last two centuries, is that people with power will abuse it, and our rights and liberties rely not on the Bill of Rights, but on how we structure government. And that's what, and Congress has been greatly at fault for not protecting its powers. James Madison assumed that each branch would protect itself and fight off encroachments. That hasn't been done by Congress, and it's not done too well by the courts. And the result is exactly what the framers feared, power placed in one branch and rights and liberties in jeopardy. Thank you very much.
Well, I too decided to go PowerPointless this morning. Though, as telling John, I do have a slide. I do have a slideshow variation of this, which, among other slides, features a photograph of John along with his alter ego Alexander Hamilton, and then one of John's early mentors, Harold Coe of Yale Law School, along with my alter ego, James Madison. I want to speak this morning primarily as an originalist. And I want to explain exactly what I mean by that term. I don't mean it in the jurisprudential sense of the term. It doesn't mean that I believe as a matter of principle that the Constitution should be always interpreted in accordance with what we call the original intentions, meanings, or understandings of its text, of its framers and ratifiers. I'm an originalist as an historian, meaning I spend most of my waking hours in the 18th century on any given day, and I spend many of those hours thinking about particular constitutional puzzles. It could be the Second Amendment, it could be reapportionment, and in recent years, and not just in recent years, it could also be issues about war powers. And I'll just say, tell a very quick personal story here. When I first got interested in this subject, well before I started working on it, it was when I was a graduate student in the early 1970s, and I was a member of an organization called Reservists Against the War, which had filed a suit against then Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger in an effort to force all those members of Congress who were holding commissions under the reserve in the reserve branches, and I was a reservist at the time, to either resign their commissions or resign their seats in Congress because the Constitution prohibits members of Congress from holding office under the executive branch. And that's what I actually first started thinking about issues of how one would talk about original intent, meaning, and understanding, because I thought on historical grounds this was a great suit. That is to say, that the framers would have agreed that members of Congress, as a matter of course, should not hold commissions in the armed forces. And I started thinking about the issues that have preoccupied me really the last 20 years, originally as a graduate student then. Now, this is important to us, I think, for a couple obvious reasons. It's not that reading the debates of 1787 give us the only answers we could possibly imagine to the dilemmas of constitutional governance we face today, and particularly which we felt very acutely over the last 7 or 8 years or so. But it is because I do believe that any serious effort to understand what the Constitution means today should at least begin with an attempt to figure out why the clauses that we have to work with, and in this case, the distribution of powers over war, national security, and foreign relations, primarily between the legislative and the executive branch. All those inquiries, it seems to me, should begin with some informed historical understanding of why the clauses in question made their way into the Constitution. There had to have been some rationale at the time. And so as a historian, and I want to present this in a disciplinary sense, as a historian, when I think about this, I need to be able to tell some story to myself, which would explain why did the framers do what they did at Philadelphia in 1787, and what would the larger American public, which was passing judgment on what they had done at Philadelphia in 1787, how would they have thought about what the framers were proposing, and how could we explain their actions in terms of their existing understandings or the concerns of the time? It's important to note this because the discussions of originalism that take place in the current academy, and particularly in the legal academy, and on the federal bench, and if you read in particular Justice Scalia's opinion in the recent D.C. Guns case, the Heller case, rely upon a different version of originalism, what's called public meaning, which I take it as a kind of dictionary exercise. It doesn't involve knowing very much about what the framers thought they were doing in Philadelphia in 87 or what they thought they were doing in New York in 1789 in terms of Bill of Rights. It imagines a kind of disinterested citizen with a lot of dictionaries and some knowledge of history reading the Constitution and asking, what does it mean on that basis? Well, my position is we want to know what the people who adopted the Constitution, those who drafted it, those who ratified it, would have thought they were doing on the basis of what they said about it. And on the basis of the history of their own period, not just on reading a dictionary. And that's what I want to try to do this morning in very short order. And, Jesse, give me the hook when you have to, because, you know, or at least let me know when I'm getting into trouble. I really only have three basic data points I want to put before you. But let me just let me state, I think, maybe in somewhat more general terms than Lou did, what I see as the basic issues that we've had to consider the last six or seven years since 9/11 being the obvious reference point. Though a lot of these debates go back at least to the early 1970s and perhaps even a little bit earlier than that. So the basic argument that the Bush administration has made, and for which, you know, by all accounts, John Yoo was a prominent proponent and spokesman, rests, and John can certainly qualify this, and I'm sure will, you know, when his turn comes, but rests, I think, particularly on two clauses of the Constitution. The one I think that's the more interesting for us to discuss has been the Commander-in-Chief Clause. And the basic argument, which I will grossly oversimplify, and John can again qualify it, but is, and I take it, you know, one way to characterize the basic argument is, when we're at war, we're in some kind of condition that resembles a war, the president is acting legitimately, perhaps with some prior congressional authorization, in his capacity as commander-in-chief, that his authority, a robust definition of his authority as commander-in-chief, essentially switches off many, if not quite all, of the corresponding provisions relating to defense and security that we find in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. That there's a kind of mantra, there's a kind of magic, there's a kind of talismanic quality to the Commander-in-Chief Clause that somehow trumps or switches off all these other relevant provisions that give Congress the authority to declare war, to make rules for captures of land and sea, to define piracy and offenses against the law of nations, to raise and support armies, and so on and so on. So the big reliance on just the inherent authority of the president's commander-in-chief has been, it seems to me, a major foundation of the administration's claims to unilateral authority. And then secondarily, there's an older argument, which really goes back to the 1790s, about the meaning of the vesting clause of Article II, the clause which says, the first sentence of Article II says, the executive power shall be vested in the president of the United States. And the question of how you define the executive power, whether it's defined primarily in terms of some 18th century conception in which British notions derived under monarchical rule would still have some salience, or whether there's a distinctly American definition of what executive power is, that's been a second major prong of the argument. And that's all I'll say about sketching the argument. We'll come back, I'm sure, talk about a lot of this in the questions and the colloquy among us. Let me just offer three data points for how I've thought about this over the last few years. And two of them are actually relatively new to me, weren't things I really knew much or thought about when I first got interested in this question, really back in the early 1970s. The last one will be a much more familiar one. Two of them are essentially British in nature. And I want to stress this because I think a big part of the argument that John and others have made does rely upon the supposition that significant components of a British way of thinking about war powers issues were somehow imported into and absorbed by the framers at Philadelphia in 1787. So the first one, I hadn't really thought much about this until a couple years ago when Neil Katyal, who argued for the defendant, I guess the appellant, Hamdan, in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, asked me to do an amicus curiae brief in support of his position. And I had to do a little bit of research in what I think remains an understudied subject. And that subject is the Mutiny Act, which is a term I bet nobody in the audience, very few people in the audience know anything about. You can put your hand up if you do. Anybody know what the Mutiny Act was? Well, it's a very interesting piece of parliamentary legislation. The first one is enacted in 1689. And it's enacted regularly on an annual basis thereafter. What does the Mutiny Act do as it evolves as a kind of basic mainstream of British parliamentary practice in the 18th century? The Mutiny Act is what gives the king, as the equivalent of a commander-in-chief, the authority to issue articles of war, meaning the authority to implement a system of military justice, meaning a system of military discipline. And it evolves into a more of a general-purpose statute in which a whole array of issues of military administration are in effect reauthorized on an annual basis. This is a critical development in British parliamentary tradition. Many of you should know. If you don't, you're about to find out that after 1689, parliaments had to meet once every 3 years under the Triennial Act. But Parliament found two ways to get around that. One was the principle of annual supplies, meaning the House of Commons would reauthorize military expenditures on an annual basis, you know, year by year. The equivalent of our Constitution, of course, is the 2-year provision for the Army, not for the Navy. Navies aren't dangerous, so you can authorize navies for long periods. The navies can't come ashore. Armies, you know, armies are on land, so they're more dangerous to the rights of the citizens. But the Mutiny Act is the administrative equivalent of that. It's a second way. So Parliament enacts the Mutiny Act, which is the basic legal authority for all matters military, including military justice, on an annual basis, thereby assuring that it has to meet every year. So this is a strong element of British Parliament tradition. It becomes something of a cliche. The Quartering Act of 1765 and the Third Amendment of our Constitution are, in a sense, derivative from it. It just establishes, I think, as a point of departure, the basic animus in the British parliamentary tradition from which we are derived, against the idea of an inherent magisterial or monarchical authority over matters of military law, administration, and justice. That's point number one. Data point number one, just think about an annual enactment whereby the entire statutory authority for military affairs has to be derived and renewed on a legislative basis. Data point number two is something I should have known better but didn't. Let's ask the question, how did the American War of Independence end? There are lots of ways you can answer that question. You know, we win a big battle at Yorktown, which for the Angelenos president is on the East Coast. It's in Virginia. What happens after Yorktown is really quite interesting. In February 1782, the House of Commons passes a resolution. After several goes around, they're in a very full house with a lot of noses being counted and recounted, parliamentary noses, that is, being counted and recounted. The House of Commons passes a resolution sponsored by former General Henry Seymour Conway. I think I got that right. Philip Seymour Conway, something like that. Veteran member of Parliament, which calls for an end to offensive operations in North America. Offensive in the military sense of the term. Lord North immediately realizes it's not technically a vote of confidence, but Lord North, the Prime Minister for 12 years, treats it as such. He realizes he has to step down. He tells that to the King. The King says, no, I really need you, but North says, no, you really have to, we really have to follow the parliamentary majority. It's such a serious blow, in the sense, to the King. The King, King George III, actually thinks about abdicating and going back to Hanover, his German principality. It's a minor point, but we think it may seem like a minor point, but let's just think about this in terms of an 18th century understanding of the relative authority of the legislature and the executive in terms of conducting and supervising military operations. The House of Commons says you have to stop offensive warfare in North America. You know, you can still protect yourself in places like New York and Charleston and Savannah, about the only places the British are at this point in 1782, but you can't undertake offensive operations. And the vote is regarded as being so authoritative that not only does the government fall because it's been taken, in effect, it takes another few weeks for North finally to leave office, not only does the government fall, but also the King himself thinks he may have to resign. And I just leave this question open to ask the question whether 5 years later the framers of our Constitution would have been more on the monarchical side or more on the parliamentary side of that discussion. Would they have thought the House of Commons had gotten wrong by not recognizing the superior authority of the Crown to conduct military operations, or would their understanding of the basic relationship between the branches not have rested upon essentially the same predicate? That even though the King has prerogative powers over war and diplomacy, meaning the King decides when the nation goes to war, and he makes treaties of his own authority without having to have them ratified by the House of Commons, or the House of Lords, or Parliament. Just think about the logic of that position. Were the American framers and ratifiers of 1787-88 more monarchical than George III had been and Lord North had been five or six years later? That's a problematic position. So those are first two data points derived from British practice. The third one, actually, for people who've studied this issue, and I don't know how many have studied this, but you should all know this by this point. There have been a number of debates that scholars like myself and John and Lou have kind of gone over endlessly from Philadelphia. The debates about the presidency, the debates, the decision in mid-August 1787 to substitute the verb declare for the verb make in the clause giving Congress the authority to declare war as opposed to simply make war. There are a lot of data points in the constitutional debates that we go over and we go over repeatedly. There's just one I really want to stress, and I'm fairly confident. I certainly hope John responds to this at some point. So there is a tradition in 18th century thinking on the British side of the scale, which says treats the authority to go to war and the authority to negotiate treaties as being part of the prerogative. That's to say, they're part of the executive power. They are thought of as executive power. And in a casual sense, that usage, I would agree with John, slips over into American practice. And the best example I have of this would be the guy I like to identify as my alter ego, James Madison, because a lot of those 18th century waking hours I spend are really spent with Madison, even now. Madison, in a very interesting letter in 1785, he writes to a college buddy of his, Caleb Wallace, August 23, 1785, says, talking about state constitutions, and he has an interesting passage. He says he really thinks that in terms of thinking about state constitutions, the executive power, which is thought of as the second branch, really ought to be relegated to a lesser position. All the great powers of the executive being transferred to the national government, meaning the kind of Congress, which is the national government, has powers over war and diplomacy. And that's a good example of Madison using that executive view. Well, maybe give me another word, one or two more. I'm almost there. I'll be fairly brief. So there's a good example of Madison using executive in that kind of traditional sense. All the great executive powers being transferred to national government has to be about war and diplomacy. The Virginia Plan, which Edmund Randolph introduces in the Constitutional Convention at the very beginning, Article 6, makes the same usage, refers to the executive rights vested in Congress by the Confederation will now be transferred to the new executive to be created under the Constitution. But this is where the discussion gets really interesting, because at this point, James Wilson from Pennsylvania, theoretically a very powerful thinker, a very powerful legal thinker, member of the first Supreme Court, gets up and he says, Wilson says, as Madison records it, did not consider the prerogatives of the British monarch as a proper guide in defining the executive powers. Some of these prerogatives were of a legislative nature, among others, meaning inter alia, or i.e., among others, that of war and peace. And at this point, far from sticking up for his original position, Madison backs down, or Madison reverses his position. We know from the notes taken by Rufus King, Madison says, Madison agrees with Wilson in his definition of executive powers ex vi termini from the force of their ends, for the Latin scholars present, executive powers ex vi termini from the force of their ends do not include the rights of war and peace. Now, this is my third data point. It's just that I just want to draw a very simple conclusion of this. That even if that casual usage was there, it is passing over, is kind of passed over into American practice. That's exactly what the framers confronted directly at the very beginning of their deliberations. And when they decided that the idea that there's an inherent executive, that the matters of war and peace were inherently executive in nature, was simply not going to be American doctrine or practice from this point on. The basic moral I take away from this will be the last point I make, and maybe I'll come back and have a chance to refine this later, is that as a historian, I just don't know what, I've read John's work, and I have some misgivings about it, to put it mildly. I just don't know what is the historical story that one could plausibly tell that would actually produce the conclusions to which the Bush administration, with significant intellectual support from John Yoo, has been committed. That's to say, what is the story we would tell that would say the framers of our Constitution, once they start thinking about this, would have wound up with a more monarchical position than that would have been practiced in Britain in the early 1780s? It just, to me, is completely implausible as a matter of what they were thinking, how they were speaking, what they were debating. We've left other debates out of this, but maybe John will say something about them, say something more. So I just, there's... Yeah, there are a lot of textual games you can play with the text of the Constitution, but when you try to figure out why it took the form it did, I'm fairly confident in the position that I've just tried to stake out. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to take up Jack's challenge directly, which is to try to tell a historical story about how the powers of war may not be so, I guess, so pro-congressional as he thinks. And I don't want to exclude Lou from this because I think Lou has very much the same views as Jack does. But let me just say to start that, as you can tell from the debates that we've had in the past and we're having now, is that there's a big gap between presidential practice and the views of academics. I think it's quite clear. I don't think anyone would dispute this, at least since the Korean War, if not earlier. Presidents have gone to war without congressional permission, and Lou has done a lot of work exactly trace out how different presidents have at times ignored Congress or refused to seek congressional authorization for the wars they've been involved with. And so the question that got me started on this is whether...
I'm a Institute of Government Studies for the Organizing Conference. I'm going to ask you, please sit down, stop interrupting the conference or other people, and hear what the panelists have to say. We hope you'll listen to it.
Excuse me, I'm more concerned about
I'm
talking.
I'm
talking.
You can't hear it.
We can't hear
it.
We can't
hear it.
The
person's
talking over here. Prior to the
conference.
Thank you. I hope everyone will listen politely and hear what the speakers have to say. Go ahead.
Thanks. So the question, at least in my mind, is there really such a large gap between practice, at least for the last 60 years, and what people think the framers intended? And it's an interesting switch of positions, because the people who are usually in favor of originalism, also usually the ones in favor of more presidential power, the people more critical, in this case, of presidential power, and lots of other, I'm not saying these are your personal views on these other issues, but usually are in favor of an evolving, sometimes people call it living constitution. But in this area, I think people who are critical of the presidency and the executive branch make very strong claims about what the framing means. And I think you got the sense of it from Lou and Jack's position. They would say that those original views ought to bind our practice today. Right? And so a lot of it has to do with how clear you think the message from the framing is. And my arguments really don't go to being able to say definitively that the president or Congress have the upper hand. My view is more that the history is not so clear, and that if anything, what the framers would have anticipated would have been a more fluid political process. So I don't think that, for example, the Commander-in-Chief Clause or the Vesting Clause switches off Congress's Article I, Section 8 powers. What I do think is that both branches have their constitutional powers, and they can use them to cooperate if they want to in matters of war, but they can also just as easily use them to try to frustrate and stop each other's policies. I think that's really the lesson of some of the historical evidence. I have to say, I feel like one of the trees that used to be outside the stadium. But I don't want to get cut down quite yet. So it seems to me that some of the evidence that Jack was talking about have to do with that. So you have, I think it's fair to say, in the 17th and really the 18th century, the struggle between the king and parliament over control of war. And while it's true that Blackstone provides this very formal description of the king's powers that are quite broad, I think in practice, I think as Jack's evidence shows, there's a much more fluid interaction between the crown and the parliament that goes well beyond what the formal powers say. So you have, for example, the British Parliament passing laws trying to end the Revolutionary War, at least ending British participation to stop the Revolutionary War. You have Britain passing the Mutiny Acts, and some of this comes to influence American understandings today. The Mutiny Act would certainly be constitutional today under the American system, because Congress has the power to pass rules governing the armed forces. The congressional law trying to end the war in British North America, what they thought of as British North America, is, if you think about the way the Vietnam War ended. In the Vietnam War, actually, I don't know if your example was really linked to funding, but you know, Congress ended the Vietnam War by cutting off all funds for any hostilities in Southeast Asia, and the president followed that law. It seems to me what you had coming out of the British experience was not just you could line up this list of powers on the king's side and this list of powers on the parliament side, but you'd want to understand how did the framers think that those powers interacted into an operating political system. And I think it's fair to say that in that system, even though the British king formally had the power to launch wars and make treaties on his own, in practice, Parliament had the upper hand because of its control over the funding and raising of the armed forces, which is what the British revolutions in the 17th century were fought about. And I think my claim would be that the framers, when they wrote up their own allocation of war powers, thought that that would primarily be the same system, that the British system of a fluid political process that allowed for a large amount of conflict between the two branches would be the same kind of system we would expect today. And so I don't think it would be a surprise to learn that immediately after the Constitution, under the Washington administration, there's already, by Washington's second term, a great deal of conflict over whether the president could articulate and enforce a neutrality proclamation in the wars between Britain and France. And already even by the 1790s, you have Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, who had once collaborated on the Federalist Papers, arguing quite vociferously about whether the executive power of the vesting clause and the commander-in-chief power allowed the president to say we weren't going to go to war on the side of France, or whether that was for Congress to decide. So one point I make is if it's so, it doesn't seem so obvious and clear to me as if within the first 10 years of the ratification of the Constitution, you have some of the leading thinkers who wrote the Constitution already fighting about its meaning. The other thing I would say is it seems to me one corollary of that point is that Congress, if you look at the list of authorities, Congress has a great deal of power to stop wars before they begin, to end wars once they've started. Even in an era of modern warfare is so expensive that no president can really wage a war of any significance without appropriations bills. Even the war in Kosovo, which was an air war with no ground troops of a limited duration, President Clinton had to go to Congress at the beginning of hostilities to seek funding, which barely passed. And at the same time, Congress, by the way, refused to declare war and tied, so did not pass an authorization approving the war. But Congress has a lot of other powers available, too, and even if after the fact, as you might say, Congress might get tricked into approving war by the executive branch, how is the power of impeachment, which I think, I don't know what Jack and Lou think about this, but my sense is that the framers thought impeachment would be more widely used than we, in fact, use it. It was a fairly common tool to remove the British ministers who just ran bad wars. It wasn't something about committing criminal acts. If you had lost a war, you could get impeached. I think the thing that has really changed is not the constitutional powers, but it's the situation that the United States finds itself in. So one thing is, if you think back to the late 18th century, the United States had no real permanent armed forces. So if you wanted to go to war in the late 18th and early 19th century, Congress would have to create the armed forces for that war. So if you look at 1789, when President Washington's inaugurated, he submits a report to Congress about the size of the armed forces at the time. The United States Armed Forces was roughly 1,000 troops. And in fact, in a few years later, was completely wiped out in a war along the borders with the Indian tribes. Actually, one of the worst military defeats armed forces have suffered. Washington had to go back and ask Congress to create a new military. So Congress had almost a complete and ineffective check over any kind of war through till the end of World War II, because it had the power to decide whether to give the president the armed forces to fight the war that he, or maybe someday she, wanted to fight. The thing that changed is that in 1945 and on, Congress and the president together have decided to create a permanent standing military of a kind, which I think the framers really did not want to see, but didn't prohibit either. And if you think about that, military is not built and designed for defensive operations of the homeland. Our military today, which is by far the largest one in the world and larger in spending than the next 25 countries after us, is designed primarily for offensive operations. It's based primarily overseas. And if you saw on 9/11, the actual military assets devoted to defense of the continental United States is actually quite small. So Congress, in a way, has created these armed forces. It's created offensively designed armed forces and created large armed forces. And that's really what, that's the first thing that's really changed, I think, that from the framers' vision that has switched the initiative to the executive branch. But mind you, even after a president chooses to use those forces in a war, Congress can just shut off the funds for those wars and stop the war immediately. And I think about that kind of power. It's not a power that you have to use affirmatively, because since appropriations have to be done continuously, not continuously, but on a regular basis, all you have to do to stop a war in Congress is just refuse to pass a bill, is to not pass, is to just be passive. The second thing, and timer's on it, that has changed, obviously, is the creation of the modern administrative state. The other big change that happened in the World War II period and after is that the powers of the presidency have expanded, I think, well beyond the original conception in terms of all the other things that the president has done, all the other things that the president does today. And, you know, one's reminded, if you look at the turmoil in the financial markets right now, everyone keeps asking, you know, what's the Bush administration going to do about it? What's the president's plan? Right? That's been a big shift in the center of political gravity, and one that's been done, again, between the cooperation of the president and Congress that have delegated large amounts of power to the executive branch. That, too, has been a big change, I think, and also leads to concerns about executive power, but is also one that's well within Congress's power to control. The last thing, I think the most important thing, and I'll end with this, and this is also, I think, tied to the growth of a large standing military, is a change in America's position in the world. Foreign affairs, I think, have not just become more important to the United States, but obviously the United States is trying to play a much more active role in the world than the framers, I think, thought they would have going to play in the late 18th century. So in the late 18th century, while these matters of war and peace were important, I don't think the framers thought that war would be a regular feature or a common feature in the American experience because of the oceans and relatively weak opponents on the continent. It doesn't mean they didn't. I mean, part of the Constitution was, in fact, to make the ability of the United States to wage war, defend the country, stronger. But I don't think they saw the sort of active interventionist role in the world that we have today. And this is not a partisan issue. I mean, this is a policy that both parties followed since 1945 on. I mean, there's debates about which particular conflicts to get involved with, but I don't think there's any serious effort to return us to a pre-World War II attitude in the United States towards foreign affairs. And so, in part, it's not, in my view, it's not that the presidency became imperial. In a way, it's that the United States became more imperial. And because of the way the Constitution is structured, the president's powers are more open-ended in this area. And so it's America's role, again, both the president and Congress, I think, have agreed with this, is that role has gotten bigger. Naturally, the powers of the presidency got bigger as well. So that'll end. Thank you.
Well, this is really quite an extraordinary group, and in many ways, I think it very nicely illustrates the dimensions of the debate here. There is a lawyer's perspective on these issues. There's a historian's historical perspective on these issues. I mean, our primary topic in this panel is the founding and the imperial presidency. There's a practitioner's model of looking at this for policymakers and policy advocates. And I think there's also a rather different political analytic model to look at this and to look at the structures of the institutions. And we have some of the very best representations of each of these approaches sitting up here. I think that there are these then raise sort of different but related debates about questions of original intent and the role and scope and dimension of the presidency. The first thing I think is worth thinking about is the utility of this debate in the first place. I mean, obviously there's a historical value in talking about what the framers and founders may or may not have said or may not have intended. But what's our ultimate objective? It tells us what we should do, tells us what we should accept or tolerate. Does it suggest or illuminate systemic flaws and needs, things that we may need to change, or at least illustrate an understanding of why we may be in what appears to be confounding circumstances? And I think it also explains to us why the outcomes, which may seem very counterproductive and counterintuitive, why we have a system that seems so aiming in directions that a lot of us aren't very happy with, actually is quite logical and quite predictable if you go back and look at the architecture of the system. And from a political analyst perspective, I think that's really the essence, is to understand how the architecture produces the circumstances that we're in. And this actually, I think, brings, and I'll come back to this in a moment, but is at the kind of core of the point on which, John, you and I agree and most disagree on the very same issue. And I think it does illustrate this distinction. In War Powers, it's hard to imagine that a generation that had only recently battled King and Parliament in the Revolution decided to mimic British forms of government, that it would want a prerogative, that it would try to establish an extraordinarily powerful executive. Now, of course, the Americans had a real problem. I mean, the Articles of Confederation had failed. The American system was in real trouble. We had the British to the north of us. We had the French to the south of us. We had the Spanish. They were all waiting to gobble this place up. So there was a real problem. But at the very core of the Madisonian dilemma was, how do you balance these two competing needs? How do you have energy in government, which was essential to make it function, and yet how do you guarantee safety against usurpation and tyranny, which is precisely what they had just turned away from and just fought against? So it is certainly true that there were many among well-educated Americans in the founding generation who certainly would have embraced a much stronger executive, a prerogative powers in a chief executive. But on the other hand, I think we have to recognize how self-consciously revolutionary this new system of government was. Madison says, "I've looked all around the world to find a model. There aren't any. They've all failed. Every model of democracy has failed." And he has to start from scratch, and he has to start a new system. He didn't simply say, "Well, we need to take the British system and make a few tweaks and changes." I mean, not at all. This is a fundamentally revolutionary, revolutionarily different system. And this was in the mind of its actual architects. Edmund Randolph, for example, spoke for many at the convention when he said that Americans rejected Britain as our prototype and instead required a different form of government. Now, it's one thing to say we need a new form of government, but that doesn't tell us what that's going to be and what the problems of that form are going to be. Louis Fisher, who's taught all of us about the separation of powers and to whom we all owe a deep debt on any question having to do with this issue, demonstrates, I think, in his book, Presidential War Power, that the framers decisively rejected the British model in war, in treaties, and in the appointment power, among other things. Now, the whole question of original intent is a highly complicated and difficult question. I mean, what do we look to for original intent? Who do we look to? The folks who wrote the Constitution in the convention in Philadelphia? Well, that was a secret convention. There were no transcripts. We don't have YouTube. We don't know actually exactly what they said. We have records that Madison kept, but Madison is a partisan. Madison had a strong point of view here. And even if we had that, even if we had a transcript, after all they were doing was proposing a document which was then sent out for ratification. So another layer of original intent says, well, we don't look at the framers, we should look at the ratifiers who were in each of the states and ratifying the convention. And, of course, they had all sorts of different views on all sorts of these different subjects. And how are we going to get at that? What they said at the ratification debates, the letters that they wrote, the documents they left behind, their reflections 20 years later, 30 years later, 100 years later, how are we going to really identify the meaning, the original intent? So we can take another step back and we can say, well, we could try that as well, but that I'll leave to the Vatican. So we can also take another step back, and we can look at a broader context of the founding generation. We can think about folks who were simply part of the democracy of which this became the governing document. So there's a real problem in identifying and working on this question of original intent. But this raises a second question, and I think this is more the question from the perspective of a political analyst, which is to say, we're not engaged purely in a historical debate. That's an interesting debate to have. But the reason we're battling over the meaning of the war powers and the separation of powers and the allocation of the powers is because we're, in fact, battling over that allocation not in 1789 but today, and we're trying to figure that out. And the president's war and foreign policy powers have grown dramatically. As John said, he's absolutely right. Whether or not they should have, the reality is, the fact is that they have. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The development of modern weapons that can reach the United States with virtually no warning, the crisis atmosphere of the Cold War, which encouraged Congress to cede more power in foreign affairs to the president, feeling incompetent to be able to deal with intercontinental ballistic missiles, and a problem of the Supreme Court, which has never endorsed this shift, but has always been uncomfortable with it. And the justices have always and consistently made clear that they would intervene, they will protect the prerogatives of Congress, but primarily and only when Congress itself acts and exhausts its own authority and its own powers. The court is not going to do, as they said in Goldwater versus Congress, we will not do what you will not do. First, Congress has to exhaust its authority, and then the court would step in. And in fact, in the recent detainee cases that have been heard by the Supreme Court, as Linda Greenhouse articulated a couple of days ago, there's been a slow and steady movement as the court has become a little bit more and a little bit more insistent, trying to send signals to the executive. They haven't taken the last step yet and actually confronted the president with a direct order to release detainees, but we are moving in that direction. And I think that's not inconsistent with what the court has done for 200 years. Those who hew to a kind of a royal prerogative view of foreign policy believe that this squares with the American revolutionary architecture because despite this shifting balance, and this is where John and I both agree and disagree, we agree that Congress technically retains the ultimate check against executive abuse. There's absolutely no question about this. The Constitution is absolutely explicit. There's only one branch that can raise money, and there's only one branch that can spend money, and that's the Congress of the United States. Now, of course, Ronald Reagan pushed this to the limits in the Iran-Contra affair when he tried to draw money off the Treasury through subterfuge in a very, very complicated system. But he did that precisely because he understood that constitutionally only Congress can draw money directly from the U.S. Treasury. So John is right, and I agree with him. This is Congress's ultimate power, and Congress can stop a war anytime it wants to. But there's a problem, because like it's sort of like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Congress always had the power. It just had to click its heels three times and do it. So why don't they do it? Well, one interpretation is because they don't want to, and the other interpretation is because they can't. And that's, I think, where John and I begin to diverge. The power of the purse still belongs to Congress. Only Congress can raise taxes. Only Congress can write a check against the U.S. Treasury. But in the late 18th century, we had no large standing armies, as John recognized, or ships in ports around the world, and a president had to secure funds in advance for any military campaign. Today, that's just not the case. A president no longer has to go to Congress before waging war. We've got more than 1.4 million active duty forces stretched across the globe. We have another 860,000 or more active reserves. The commander-in-chief can deploy the armed forces on a moment's notice. The power of the purse is, at best, a way to stop adventures after they've started. And that's the problem, because once they've started, then politics begins to enter into this, and the political structure, the architecture of the political system, begins to enter into this in an important way. It is technically possible for Congress to cut off money. It is politically nearly impossible to do so with troops in the field. It's a lesson that we learned in Vietnam, and it's a lesson that Jack Murtha learned in Extremis a few months ago. When a president asks Congress to support a war in advance, moreover, you've got another problem. A majority is required to decide the question. To go to war requires 50% plus one. To get $89 billion in additional funding requires 50% plus one. That's not easy, but it's not that hard. But here's the problem. If Congress wants to cut off that money, it doesn't take 50% plus one because the president will veto it. It takes 66% to turn it around. So it's 50% to give the power, and it's 66% to get it back again. It's a one-way ratchet of power, which is a structural problem built into the constitutional system. That may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing, but it's a reality, and it's a reality of the architecture that's at play here. It's been further complicated because of profound changes in the American system. This is a system designed in 1789, and it was a system predicated by Madison on the assumption that individuals would protect and defend the powers of the institution of which they were a part. Members of Congress would fight for congressional power. Members of the executive would fight for executive power. The executive's doing just fine. They're fighting real well for their power. Members of Congress, another story entirely. Now, this could just be because they actually agree with the policy, and it could be because they're just weak and not very impressive. But I don't think that's the story. I think you have to look at what's changed in Congress. The structure of the parties have changed. The structure of the nominating conventions have changed. Who runs for Congress has changed. How we look at congressional careers has changed. Sam Rayburn honestly believed that the Speaker of the House was more powerful than the United States President and wouldn't have traded jobs. you know, if you whistle in the U.S. Senate, there'll be 49 people ready to be president in 22 seconds. The idea that being a member of the Senate or the House is the equivalent of being in the White House just has changed in dramatic ways. Campaign finance has a lot to do with this. These poor people spend all their time raising money. They're not actually legislating. They're not becoming the barons and lions of the Senate that they once were. Career patterns have changed, and these political reforms have changed. This ratchet problem is not a theoretical problem. It's a real problem. In 1970, after more than 47,000 Americans died in Vietnam, Congress voted to repeal the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which had been used since 1964 by Johnson and Nixon as evidence of congressional authorization of the war. But Nixon said that the repeal was, quote, without binding force or effect, and he continued to pursue the war for another 3 years. Why didn't Congress cut off the money? Well, they tried. Solid majorities voted to end funds for military operations in 1970 and again in 1971. They finally prevailed in 1973, but the law didn't go into effect until August 15th, well after the Paris Peace Accords had formally ended the war. The power of the purse is no match at this moment for these political and structural reasons for a determined president once troops are in the field, once men are and women are at risk of life and limb. It becomes extraordinarily difficult to make any change about this. So I think we have to think not only about what the framers had in mind and what they anticipated, but how that architecture does or doesn't apply in a modern context. And I think this is part of what we really do want to explore and think a little bit about. The constitutional powers haven't changed, but incentives and constraints have changed. And I'll leave it at that point.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.